We made this.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Movie Palace. I'm your host, as ever, Carl Sweeney. This week's episode is actually a bit of a departure from what we normally do on the podcast. You're about to hear a crossover episode hosted by my good friend, Tony Black, who I'm sure you'll remember from some previous Movie Palace episodes. Some Like It Hot, most recently, I think. Now, Tony is soon to launch The New Wave, which will focus on American cinema from the late 1960s to the early 1980s. So it's very much a show that we'll get into some different areas than we usually do here. And what you're about to hear is a sneak peek crossover. Tony's not quite ready to launch The New Wave just yet, but hopefully hearing this episode now will whet your appetite for what he's got coming up. Personally, I was thrilled that Tony invited me to be the guest on the first full episode of his podcast, which I'd strongly encourage you to subscribe to and to follow on social media. You can search for @NewWavePod on Twitter. And just before we get going, let me give you a quick reminder that you can follow We Made This, the podcast network that brings you the Movie Palace and many other great shows. Go to @WeMadeThisPod on Twitter for further details. Okay, let's go on with today's show, which begins with Tony's theme music.
Welcome, everyone, to the first official episode of The New Wave, a podcast all about the new Hollywood era of the 1960s through to the 1980s on the We Made This podcast network. I'm your host, Tony Black, and today we begin our focus on the year that started it all, 1967, with the seminal picture that is considered the beginning of the new Hollywood, Arthur Penn's Bonnie and Clyde. And joining me to discuss the film, in a crossover from our We Made This sibling podcast, our big brother, The Movie Palace, is no, I can't think of anyone better, is film scholar and media lecturer and my friend, Carl Sweeney. How are you, mate?
You forgot douchebag if you wanted to give me my full title. Yeah, I'm good.
Look, I was being generous, you know.
Yeah, I look forward to setting a low bar that all your subsequent guests can fly over. No, I'm delighted to be here for the first, this is the first full episode, isn't it? I know it's not the first thing you've put out, but
yeah
it's great.
Yeah, we've had the primer, just sort of teeing up the concept and talking a little bit about sort of your territory, really, with the Movie Palace and a little bit about the history leading up to the point Bonnie and Clyde comes in. So, yeah, I mean, that's the old Hollywood system, in a great degree, is kind of your bread and butter with that particular podcast, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I suppose what we major in on the Movie Palace is the more what you'd call the classical Hollywood era. You know, the studio system era up to about this point. I mean, this is a really interesting film because it's right on the borderline of what I would sort of consider doing and probably wouldn't do, like, just off my own back on that podcast, because I associate it more with the era you're covering. But there are some points that kind of overlap. So, yeah, it's interesting. And I think it's a very interesting time because it's, you know, the kind of people you'll be talking about, the kind of Scorsese's and the Spielbergs and so on, they kind of, at this point, are kind of coexisting with people like, who are still making films like Hitchcock, you know, and Billy Wilder. It's a really fascinating time where, like, the new is kind of coming in and supplanting the old, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think it's kind of the reason that I wanted to touch on that era and really get into it, because I've realised, as I've got older and I've become more of a fan of cinema, that it's probably my favourite era. You know, the late 60s into the early 80s, with you know, quite a lot of notable exceptions in the 90s when you and I grew up, because we're of roughly similar age, a few years between us, but not much.
Yeah, you're
and
older.
I'm yeah, just thanks for pointing that out. I was going to leave audiences to wonder who sounds the oldest, but no, he's me. But yeah, it you know, we obviously have got a lot of interesting stuff to come, but also this particular era, as you say, is particularly potent with some of the most amazing kind of films, ranging from Bonnie and Clyde all the way through to Star Wars, you know, and you couldn't have, in many ways, more different styles of filmmaking, and it's all brewed up in this real hodgepodge. So it's going to be fascinating, and I mean, we may well have quite a lot of Movie Palace listeners who've come over to this spin-off series. Well, but what I would say is, in the reverse, if there's anyone who's new to the New Wave, please do go and check out the Movie Palace, because it's also a We Made This Podcast Network show, and it is, in many ways, a big inspiration for this podcast. So, yeah, this is your call to arms to go further, deeper into classic Hollywood after this.
Yeah, well, I'll be watching those download numbers to see if there's a spike after this. But yeah, I think... and also, I mean, on that podcast, I've kind of tried to expand what exactly it is that we do. So there are some instances where I've covered a more contemporary film with a link to older cinema. So things like The Aviator or Stan and Ollie, for instance. But yeah, never anything quite like Bonnie and Clyde, I don't think. And I think you're right, and I think you've probably covered this in good detail in your primer, but it's just a very interesting sign of this paradigm shift that the new Hollywood brings, isn't it? Where we get these big directors who are able to sort of get their visions across, and then that kind of gives way though. Like you mentioned things like Star Wars, and we get the beginnings of this more kind of corporatist blockbuster culture as well. But at a time when that, you know, when that emerges with things like Jaws and Star Wars, you can't really tell exactly where it's going. So you sort of see the beginnings of it. But yeah, just in general, a time where there's a great artistic flowering, isn't there, in American cinema? I mean, with some kind of caveats. Like, you probably aren't going to be discussing too many films by women directors on this podcast. And
Sadly not.
But I mean, there are a few. But, and you know, even maybe it's arguably not the best time to be an actress, because a lot of the films we look at as being, like, canonical from this period are very much masculine pieces. But that's not to take away from the fact you've got films like, you know, Taxi Driver, The Godfather, and so on, that even today you'd look at as being some of the finest films of all time, I think, and I think many people would say.
That's true. There is a level of gender equality that's missing in this era. That is doubtless something that we will, you know, touch on, and we will talk about, and we will try and you know, dig into, in that there are one or two exceptions, and we will try and seek them out, I think, on the run of the New Wave. But it is a really interesting time. And I think you've nicely sort of summed up what new Hollywood in many ways is, you know, that new Hollywood idea, which we will talk about more in this discussion of Bonnie and Clyde, because it's so crucial. But it is that, you know, changeover point for cinema. It is that, it is a time when we start to see, you know, a different kind of auteur. We start to see a different kind of approach in terms of filmmaking. We start to see particularly cinema and politics really sort of become intertwined. That happens in Bonnie and Clyde as well. So there's loads and loads of things, and it will be a fascinating journey, really, hopefully, to get into. And this is the perfect place to start. Bonnie and Clyde was released in cinemas on August 13th, 1967, directed by Arthur Penn, from an original screenplay by Robert Benton and David Newman, and plenty of revisions by Robert Towne, even though they're not always necessarily referenced by some people. Warren Beatty stars as Clyde Barrow, a handsome young Texan small-time crook who takes under his wing the beautiful restless waitress Bonnie Parker in a breakout role for Faye Dunaway, and proceeds to kickstart together a violent bank-robbing crime spree across Texas during the early days of the Great Depression in the 1930s. As Bonnie and Clyde become a national sensation and the law closes in, they begin to draw in a range of other people into their web of lawlessness as the net tightens around them, and they begin to realise they may not be able to escape a deadly fate. So, Carl, you have seen Bonnie and Clyde more than once, so tell us your first experience of the film, and generally, what do you make of this one?
I can't really remember my first experience that clearly. It was a few years ago on TV, I think. I must have recorded this off TCM or something. I can't really remember. The interesting thing with Bonnie and Clyde, and like you said, I've seen it more recently as well, seen it a few times. Bonnie and Clyde's a film I admire a lot. It's not a film I can put my hand on my heart and say that I love. And I can't quite put my finger on the reason why, but I think that some of that might be... I think it's really hard to understand as a, you know, as somebody living in 2020, just exactly, you know, I think it's hard to understand just what a stir this caused in 1967. And I think it's hard to fully put yourself in the shoes of somebody living at that time. I think you can understand it to some extent on like an intellectual level, but I think it's hard to understand that on more of a visceral level. So things like, you know, people like you and I were so, you know, kind of numbed from like the violence we've seen in all kinds of cinema. But I think it's hard to understand the kind of shock to the system that Bonnie and Clyde must have been for a lot of people in that respect, for instance. So yeah, it's a film I think it's very important though. I think it's very significant. it probably wouldn't make it onto a list of like my favourite films. That's what I'm saying. So there's always been that kind of arm's length feeling for me with it. I don't know if that's similar or comparable to you at all. That's kind of how I've always felt.
I think that's a really good point in that we have become desensitized to an extent, and it wouldn't necessarily have the impact that it would have done were we watching it back then. I mean, we weren't born obviously at the time this first came out. I didn't see it until a few years ago when I was starting to get into this period of cinema and starting to try and explore older things. But I think it really, and maybe on the second time around, I really felt like how it really sort of struck me how powerful in a way it is, like, and how shocking to some extent it feels without. Yes, we've seen far more violent things in the last 50 years, but there is something quite ragged and edgy and disturbing about this story and the way it's presented and the way this film is made that I think is really quite striking even now. You know, it, to the point that I don't think, and we're jumping massively ahead here, but I don't think I've still ever quite seen an ending like Bonnie and Clyde in terms of how fast cut their deaths are, and you know, the sheer balletic, weirdly romantic violence of the whole thing, which, you know, has been ported into things like, you know, from all kinds of different sort of crime films over the years in many ways. You know, even I'd say that Tarantino has borrowed from things like that, you know. But I still think it holds a rawness, this film, that is unusual. Unusual then and unusual now. So it's not one of my favourite movies, but I do think it's, and I know you do feel the same, it's really quite remarkable for so many reasons, and it really stands up today.
It's a remarkable film, and it's an important film, like I say, and the reason it's important is because it marks a break with the past. And it paved the way for what lots of other films did. And if we're talking specifically about sort of gangster films here, what it gives you is, in some ways, it's detached in some ways. It gives you a detached period recreation. I can talk a bit about what I mean by that. But it shifts attention away from... So gangster films have always been characterised by being quote-unquote realistic. And I think with something like Bonnie and Clyde, and with films like Mean Streets and The Godfather, you move towards something else. You see these films and there's more of a wider sense that what we're seeing are, you know, it's hard to lose sight of the fact that what you're watching is a film. It's got attention-grabbing editing. You know, it's got really interesting artful compositions, attention-grabbing performances. So that's part of it, I think. I think it's hard to get immersed in it and forget that you're watching characters, you know what I mean? And we can talk more about that, but I think it's definitely significant because the thing is, this is a film that appealed not just to, like, you know, critics and people like that who maybe have more of a rarefied take, but eventually it became a big success with the ticket buying public as well. So it's interesting. It kind of marks the start of this period where you get a few more kind of high profile gangster films and also things like crime dramas and police thrillers. Whereas, like, the gangster film's heyday had been in the 1930s. So you don't get the same kind of level of output after this, but you get an upsurge, definitely. And I think Bonnie and Clyde's, you know, in large part is responsible for that.
Yeah, and it's got some really interesting influences to it, hasn't it, this film? You know, I mean, let's talk a little bit about the gangster stuff, because I think one or two films, and you know a bit more about this because of your classical film knowledge, but there is... a couple of different films are referenced. Things like Howard Hawks' Scarface, which is obviously a classic from the 30s. And there's particularly a film that I think influenced Arthur Penn and the writers, Robert Benton and David Newman, which was called Gun Crazy from Joseph L. Lewis in 1949, I think. And it's a film that I was trying to find time to watch, actually, to record this, but I haven't been able to get around to it yet, but I am keen to. And one of the key signifiers of that film is that it has the main character, who's played by an actress called Peggy Cummins, is wearing a very Bonnie Parker-esque beret, you know, as they go on these crime sprees and things like that. And it was a film that was also beloved, and we'll talk a little bit about this, I think, in a minute, but beloved by Jean-Luc Godard of the you know, the French Nouvelle Vague, which has its own influence on Bonnie and Clyde. But in terms of the gangster film, I mean, what do you think about that? Do you see, particularly in Scarface, do you see the connective tissue there?
Not necessarily with Scarface so much, because Scarface is more of a kind of racketeer film. So with the gangster film, you sort of have two main archetypes with the gangster film. You have the racketeer and the outlaw. So the racketeer are these figures who are more inspired by people like Al Capone, you know, bootleggers and things like that. I think with the outlaw, the sort of historical reference points are more like people, like the real life Bonnie and Clyde. I think John Dillinger, the main one, you know, more like armed robbery. But yeah, it's interesting. I think what the gangster film does, you always get somebody in the gangster film. It might be a group, it might be a man, it might be a woman. They're kind of opposed to society in some way. And when the gangster film first appeared with stuff like Scarface, well, to be honest, the gangster film goes back further than that, but a lot of people point to the early 30s where you got stuff like The Public Enemy, Scarface, Little Caesar, kind of a spate of them that were very influential. That was very much about the real world. It was kind of brought about because of the real world appearance of people like Capone. Now, the interesting thing with Bonnie and Clyde is that we've got something here that's based on real figures, but it's much more kind of metaphorical than those earlier films were. So it's still kind of dependent on these real-world gangsters, but it's in Bonnie and Clyde, it's taken to another level. So it kind of demonstrates how the gangster film can be just like adapted to reflect all sorts of diverse issues. You know, you get gangster films where really it's about communism, or really it's about the role of women in society or whatever. The gangster becomes a bit of a vessel for exploring these issues, in other words. So what's interesting with Bonnie and Clyde is that in the gangster film broadly, a bit of a shift occurs. So in the earlier films, it's quite easy to tell the difference between like the underworld and the regular, the more moral world. I think in later films, like in something like The Godfather, for instance, it seems like everybody's crooked. You know, it's not just the gangsters, it's the politicians, it's the businessmen as well. And they were always kind of the traditional outlaw film, things like Scarface, they're very much confined to the city. Sort of traditional racketeer films, I should say. With the outlaw films, it's less about a city environment. So in Bonnie and Clyde, they're very mobile, aren't they? They're kind of all over the place. But yeah, I think it's just a very interesting genre, because like if you think about most genres, what are they titled after? It's normally titled after a concept of some kind. You know, the sci-fi film, the horror film, the romantic comedy. With the gangster film, it's about that main figure. It's about the gangsters themselves. They're titled after an individual. It just shows how central the gangsters are to that appeal. So you can see how many of these films have like gangsters in the titles. You know, think of like Little Caesar, The Godfather, Scarface, and of course Bonnie and Clyde. So yeah, it's interesting because, like I say, it marks a break with the past in some ways, but it's definitely inspired by earlier films. Like you mentioned, Gun Crazy, and I think Fritz Lang's You Only Live Once. There's even, you know, the Bonnie Parker story from 1958. You know, there's kind of a cycle of gangster films that was about these real-world figures, kind of biopic-type exploitation pictures. So, yeah, it's very much in that kind of lineage.
I mean, that's really interesting because I don't think, when people think of the gangster film, I think automatically, a lot of the time, they conjure up images of you know, Edward G. Robinson in the old days, you know, or in more of the 70s kind of aesthetic. Yeah, you know, The Godfather, Marlon Brando, all these kind of things. That is kind of the cultural, you know, footprint for these things. But yeah, it is quite diverse. And I think Bonnie and Clyde is different in that, you know, you mentioned that there's a metaphorical aspect to it, in that they feel it's more about them as characters in some respects, I think, in terms of how they're reacting to the world, as opposed to the world they're in almost. You know, there is something about the way they, what this life brings out of them and what it's about in terms of their psychology, which is particularly fascinating in this film. And I'm guessing that goes back to another influential point, which is the French New Wave, which is, you know, obviously this podcast is called The New Wave, but we're talking about the New Hollywood. And there are alternate names for that. You know, the New Hollywood is also known as the American New Wave. But that whole lexicon comes from the Nouvelle Vague, you know, the 1950s transformation of French cinema, which brought in sort of an embodiment of very kind of, there's probably a better way to describe this, and I'm by no means a scholar yet in the French New Wave. It's an area I do need to go and really investigate. But the idea, I think, behind it was that there was much more of a naturalism in terms of how films were made. And you may be able to describe this a little bit better, Carl, but the idea being that the main adherents of this, people like Godard have mentioned, Francois Truffaut, they didn't like the idea of a film. And then one of the reasons they didn't like a lot of classic American films necessarily, or some of them, was that they didn't like the idea that a film was a completely sort of put together, locked in kind of product. They wanted it to be a bit more freeform, and they wanted to create that level of, you know, languorousness. And you see that in films like, I think, Breathless, which is much more about that sort of French cool, you know, in the early 60s. And I think Jules Ejambe is another one that may heavily inspired the writers for this. I think Robert Benton said he saw it like 12 times. So I think there's a naturalism to Bonnie and Clyde that is very much an echo of that kind of cinema.
Yeah, so I think the sort of broad brush context for the French New Wave, and I'll simplify this, I think, but during the Second World War, France had been cut off from American cinema. And it meant that when the war ended, they were kind of deluged with several years worth of, you know, American commercial product. And they started to, because they were getting it, you know, in that way, you know, so close together, they were able to see these patterns. And it's where we start to get an awareness of things like film noir and notable directors and things like that. Now, yeah, these people like Godard and Truffaut, they were critics, first of all, for Cahiers du Cinéma magazine. And they had kind of a polemical stance. They weren't happy with the way French cinema had developed. They called it Le Cinéma du Papa, I think. Kind of like your old man's films is what they meant.
Yeah.
Like these conservative kind of stolid kind of pictures. So the level to which they were inspired by American cinema is interesting, because there was kind of a split in the group, I think, between those who saw it as more kind of commercialized and those who could see that there were these directors who were kind of imprinting their stamp on American films. But yeah, so but then when they became filmmakers in their own right, they were much more kind of experimental. So experimenting with things like freeze frames and jump cuts and so on. But I think they were still kind of, they did have kind of a romantic attachment to American cinema. So they were still making things like that were in the American tradition in certain ways, like and playing around with like gangster archetypes and things. I think someone like Godard, I think he kind of lost faith with a lot of his collaborators because they became a bit too Americanized. But yeah, I think more broadly, it's just a sense that the rules could be broken. You know, I think if classical American cinema, you know, the idea is that editing is invisible. You don't do anything that distracts the audience from the story. The filmmaking should be invisible. I think with the French New Wave, it's more about the presence of the director can be signaled more, you know, more obviously, more ostentatiously. And yeah, you definitely see that in Bonnie and Clyde. I think that's part of where I'm coming from when I say it feels a bit detached to me. And what I'm talking about are things like, you know, we get the banjo music in the film, for instance. And there are times where that works really well with what's going on screen. And there are other times where it seems to kind of run against it to me. And there are other things too, like with the first robbery we see Clyde carry out. And we get like a very long shot of Bonnie out on the street. So you get these very like artful compositions. It's not the way I would have filmed it if I wanted to like really draw the audience in, for example. And I never quite lose sight of the fact that I'm watching Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway give performances. Like, I don't feel they necessarily disappear into those roles. I think they're very good, but it's not the kind of thing like when you go on to talk about people like early De Niro, for instance, and the idea is that he kind of disappears into the role. It's not necessarily what I feel here. So it's really interesting. And like, I think a lot of that is probably intentional. It's not necessarily even a criticism, but it's why I think Bonnie and Clyde is, to some extent, it's weird. It's detached in some ways, and in other ways, it's very, very much not.
I'm guessing it's because there's a stylistic element to the whole thing that outweighs the that level of performance. I mean, you know, I know it would have been a very different film, and he probably wouldn't have fitted the role at all. But had Marlon Brando played Clyde, you would have had much more of that so-called method, which is exactly what you're talking about with De Niro. You know, that idea that they lose themselves into a role. And it's something that we will go on and talk about in things like when we talk about Reflections in a Golden Eye later on in this run, which does star Brando in the same year. That is all about that sort of immersion into a part. Whereas Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway are more... Well, the big thing with the two of them is that they are film stars, first and foremost. I mean, this was Faye Dunaway's first major role. She was working in theatre at the time, and she's always been, as it's described, quite a difficult character. You know, she can be quite irascible, I think. She can be quite verbal. She often has clashed with collaborators and things like that. So nobody quite knew what to make of her or whether or not she'd be a success in the role. But Beatty was already fairly established, but as a leading man, but as in theory, one of the new versions of, say, a Montgomery Clift coming through, you know, somebody who had the look of a film star, you know. But he didn't want to go down that road. He wanted to follow more of an individualist path. And it's why I think it's interesting. I think almost Beatty follows the precepts of something that was partly an inspiration for the writing of Bonnie and Clyde from Benton and Newman, who were first and foremost journalists, which I suppose is almost in a similar way, in its own way, along the same lines as like Truffaut and Goddard being film critics, in that they came from a journalistic background and they wrote Bonnie and Clyde. And they wrote a piece for Esquire in the early 60s called The New Sentimentality. And it's a really interesting article. And the essential backbone of it is that they've described it as they were talking about the 60s before they knew what the 60s, quote unquote, was, and before it was defined as such. But they were talking about counterculture, basically, and they were talking about the overthrowing by the post-war generation of the idea of an ideal or a cause, and to make the pursuit of life essentially an individualist one. And it's a really interesting piece because it's touching on the difference between what they call the new sentimentality, which is this mindset of going out there, being your own person, making the world, you know, morph around you, as opposed to the old sentimentality, which is described in terms of 50s ideals like Eisenhower and the Norman Rockwell kind of nuclear family and, you know, mom and apple pie and the girl down the street. You know, that those kind of values that for Americans were ingrained in that immediate post-war period, but in the 60s were starting to change, you know, and particularly overlapping with Vietnam, which was another sort of subtextual influence on Bonnie and Clyde. And I think, I don't know about you, but I think Warren Beatty kind of exemplifies that new sentimentality in a way. And it's one of the reasons why I think he fitted very well with not just his role as Clyde, but his role as a producer. And if it wasn't for Warren Beatty, this film never would have been made.
Yeah, he's very interesting in that respect because he's a very hands-on kind of figure. And, you know, there are films like What's New Pussycat where he kind of backs out when it becomes clear he won't be able to exert that level of autonomy, for instance. Yeah, it's very true. And of course, he goes on to be a filmmaker, even an Oscar-winning filmmaker. I think he won the Oscar for Reds in towards the tail end of the era you're kind of covering on this podcast, really. So yeah, I think that's very true. Yeah, I think the broader kind of cultural issues that you talked about there are kind of interesting because, yeah, Bonnie and Clyde, it reflects the fact that the film industry is in this state of flux. It's going into this state of transition. But also, yeah, the broader cultural uncertainty is very significant too. Like, the 1960s was a time of momentous upheaval, really, in American history, wasn't it? For various reasons, you know, like, you kind of started to touch on there, you know, the Kennedy assassination, the sexual revolution, civil rights, women's rights movement, Vietnam, you know. So I think that's, when I'm talking about this kind of push-pull in Bonnie and Clyde, where sometimes I feel it's detached, sometimes it's not, it's very visceral, that's kind of illustrative of the sensibilities of the time, which are very uncertain too. So I think much of it is intentional. For instance, I think that in the book Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, Peter Biskin says that Arthur Penn had said that he wanted that image of Clyde's head being blown away at the end to remind audiences of the shooting of President Kennedy, you know. So all these things are kind of baked into the film. So like some of the things that I'm saying that may sound like criticisms, they're not really. I think it's a tip. Again, it speaks to why it might be hard for some people to tap into Bonnie and Clyde much later, you know, after the fact, though, because I think it speaks to that moment. I saw Roger Ebert's review of the film, and it was one of Ebert's reviews early on in his career that made his name. But he says, "It is quite possible that Bonnie and Clyde will be seen as the definitive film of the 1960s, showing with sadness, humour and unforgiving detail what one society had come to. The fact that the story is set 35 years ago doesn't mean a thing. It had to be set sometime, but it was made now, and it's about us." So I think he's right. And I think, again, to return to the broader gangster point, this is a point where the gangster film becomes less interested in reflecting what's going on in the news, you know, in terms of real-life gangsters. They start to use, you know, like The Godfather, for instance, is set in the 40s and 50s, but it's very much a metaphor about American society. They start to sort of appeal to the past to bring these things through. But it's also illustrative of these other distinct things that gangster films start to do at about this time, namely use colour at a time when they used to be almost exclusively in black and white. They get much more violent, and you get the emergence of like distinctive individual directors. And somebody like Penn is maybe not a household name in the way somebody like Scorsese is, for instance, or Coppola. He's maybe not as much of an auteur exactly as people like that. But it's a film where you sort of watch it and you, at least I do, I'm sort of thinking about what the director's doing. Like with things like that end sequence where you talked about the rapid editing and stuff like that. It's hard to, you know, you're very much aware of the presence of the director, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I think you're right about Penn in that, I mean, it's interesting watching particularly his last film before this, The Chase, which starred Brando, actually, talking about Brando a minute ago. Really great cast, you know, Robert Duvall, Jane Fonda, you know, loads of people in that film who were, you know, significant actors or new actors coming through. It was almost, in a way, a little bit of a blend of old and new, that film. And it was a sort of a neo-noir, sort of southern potboiler, but it's incredibly languid, you know, and really quite stodgy. And it was not an experience any of them enjoyed. They didn't enjoy. Matt Robert Redford was a key part of that film as well. He was one of the main characters, one of his first roles. And none of them really enjoyed making it. And you can kind of see that it just doesn't really work. So when he goes from that, Penny's on the verge of quitting. You know, he's come off. He made a film called Mickey One with Warren Beatty, which wasn't successful. It didn't do very well, and I think they enjoyed working together, even though they were sometimes quite adversarial, and they were on Bonnie and Clyde, but in a good way. They didn't have a great experience with that, and he was ready to leave. He was ready to go back to New York, direct theatre, give up the movies. You know, the thing to bear in mind is that he wasn't young in the same way as Beatty. Beatty's like 30 when he makes this film. Arthur Penn's already like in his mid-40s, so he's been around for a while. He's made films for a while. And he's edging into middle age, in fact, you know, at the point that even though he's one of the key directors for the rebirth of the birth of this new Hollywood, he's not a young, up-and-coming person. But he's enticed by the idea of Bonnie and Clyde, and because he enjoys the French New Wave. And the thing is, they tried to get Truffaut to make Bonnie and Clyde. You know, all through the early 60s, they were courting Truffaut, Benton and Newman, going to Paris. You know, he was actively involved in putting ideas together for the film, some of which probably bled into the film in some ways in terms of the script. You know, he did a lot of work on that and initially. And ironically, one of the reasons he didn't want to do it was because he didn't like Warren Beatty. he wasn't a fan. and I mean, Godard also was tempted to make it. And they were directors who liked the idea of, possibly through some level of ego, of actually being able to come into the American system and do their thing. But in the end, the only person I think who was seriously considered beyond those guys was Arthur Penn. And he took quite a lot of convincing to come aboard and do this film. But then he eventually liked enough of what he saw, and he was enough convinced by Warren Beatty that they had something special. And he brings a really interesting aesthetic to it. He brings... the word auteur is French, isn't it? I mean, in many ways, I think it probably stems a lot from the Nouvelle Vague, doesn't it? It probably stems a lot from those kind of directors, this idea of the auteur, which has, you know, become part of the cinematic lexicon since. But Penn isn't like an auteur, like you say. He's not a household name. He's not necessarily that showy either. You know, I mean, that stuff at the end with the rapid cuts is a really fascinating way to go with it. But throughout the film, I don't feel like there are those pen markers. You know, like you watch a Scorsese film and you know it's a Scorsese film. You know, or you watch a Tarantino film, you know it's a Tarantino film. I don't know if, and maybe it's because I haven't watched enough Arthur Penn films, admittedly, yet, but I don't know if that is present with him or whether he's really got a really interesting blend of being able to tell a visual story alongside another major contributor to this, which was Bernard Guffey, who was the cinematographer. But also he's good with performers. And I think that's probably one of the things with Arthur Penn, in that he knows how to get a good performance because he's got that theatrical background.
Yeah, Penn's one of those figures. I've only seen a few of his films, to be honest. I've never really done a deep dive. I never felt compelled to, is the honest truth. So I've seen Bonnie and Clyde. I've seen Little Big Man, which is a few years later with Dustin Hoffman. And I've seen The Missouri Breaks, which is with Jack Nicholson and Marlon Brando.
Somebody recommended that to me, actually, the other day on Twitter, and said it was really good.
It's interesting. It's one of those films where, like, Brando had this thing where he could just kind of really upend a film with his eccentricities, and that's very much an example of that. So yeah. That's kind of... I appreciated that, but it was kind of hard to fully go with it for me. But it's a very interesting, like, curiosity, definitely. So, yeah, the sense I get, though, because just from the broader sense I get, is that, yeah, we wouldn't necessarily think of Penn in the same way we would think of somebody like Scorsese. But nevertheless, I think that, like I said, I think gangster films like Bonnie and Clyde, like The Godfather, like Mean, specifically the Scorsese films, especially those films, I think, you're more likely to notice the director at certain points. I mean, it really contrasts with what came before. Like, these earlier gangster films they are talking about that they might have been inspired by, I don't know, you're more likely to feel the heavy hand of Warner Brothers behind a film like The Public Enemy, for instance, than you are to associate it with the director, William Wellman, because it fits very much into the studio's style. This is what's going on with these films you're talking about in this podcast, is that that paradigm very much changes as the old studio system gives way. So, not just a gangster film, but all sorts of genres take on these different qualities. So yeah, I know, I don't know if you were going to talk about the kind of Warner Brothers aspect of this here, but it's really interesting, isn't it? Because it speaks to the kind of old-new dichotomy that's going on with Bonnie and Clyde, I think.
Yeah, because it's sort of in the middle, I think, of what you're talking about, in that Warner Brothers eventually financed this film, but Jack Warner, who's coming towards the end of his life, he's got about another 10 years in him, I think, and he's obviously a legend by this point. He hates the film. He hates what it represents, you know, and he's that very much that old guard who, you know, because at the time, the production code, the classic sort of production code is collapsing, and that collapses through various different films over the course of 1967 into the end of the 60s, and that by pretty much it's gone by then. So he doesn't like what Bonnie and Clyde represents, and there's loads of great stories, aren't there, about this? There's the whole idea that the rumour that Warren Beatty sort of genuflected in front of Warner and kissed his kissed his feet to get him to make the film. And my favourite story, which is that Jack Warner, there was a legend about how Jack Warner used to, and a lot of this comes from books like Scenes from a Revolution by Mark Harris and Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, which you've mentioned, which are fantastic books for this period. But there's a classic story about how Jack Warner, whenever somebody would come in and they disagree with him, he'd take them to the window in his office, point outside at a big sign that said Warner Brothers, and he'd say, what does it say on there? And they'd say, Warner Brothers. And he'd say, okay, well, when it says your name on there, you know, if your name's Freeman or whatever, when it says Freeman Brothers, that's when you can make the decisions. And he does the same to Warren Beatty, and he takes him to the window and he says, because Warren Beatty's, you know, disagreeing with him, and he says, what does it say out there? And the whole routine. And Warren Beatty says, well, it's got your name, Jack, but it's got my initials. It's a great story. And, you know, whether it's apocryphal or not doesn't matter. It's an example of the idea that Warren Beatty really fought tooth and nail against a system that really didn't want to see a film like Bonnie and Clyde come together for a lot of the reasons, that a lot of the themes and a lot of the ideas it was talking about. I think particularly the not just the violence, but also the sex, because that is so crucial to Bonnie and Clyde. You know, the sexual aspect. I mean, apart from the fact that, you know, Beatty and Dunaway are sexy, you know, there's no getting around that. They are hot. You know, they are in the modern day. You watch them today and there's a bit of a four factor to them both. There is, you know. And there's a rawness to it as well. I mean, I really feel, particularly Dunaway, she was cast so brilliantly in the end, because there is a real sense of, I mean, I don't mean this in an insulting way at all, but a sense of sultry, almost trampiness to Bonnie that is powerful, you know, and that's why I think, and it's all in Dunaway's really good performance, and that's why I think it's all the aspects, particularly Clyde's impotence, you know, throughout the film, Bonnie's sexual frustration that she wants that side of the relationship. You really feel that, you know, in that Clyde saying things like, "Oh, you know, I'm not a lover boy," but then you've got the scenes of when he's first about to stick up a bank and he's got his gun. And it's pointed out like it's a dick. And she and she reaches over and she strokes the gun. There's lots of visual stuff as well as verbal that I think is fascinating to the psych. Like I mentioned, the psychology of the film and these two performances which dovetail into each other brilliantly.
It's interesting, right? Because I think the thing with, yeah, the sexuality generally is very much there. And you even see that in Dunaway's first scene where she's kind of rolling around the bed. She seems kind of, you know, kind of frustrated and like a prisoner, and that's why Clyde turning up appeals to her, I think. But the thing with the impotence, though, I'm not sure if that really works for me, to be honest, because you talked about the naturalism of the film, but like Clyde's impotence is presented as like a narrative problem that he overcomes. So I don't know if that's as... That seems a bit more simplistic to me than the rest of the film. It's interesting, though, and it seems like there have been some sanded off edges as well. Like, there are things like the mechanic, CW's tattoo that Bonnie helped him pick out. And it seemed like there was some kind of thing, you know, they might have gone in some different directions with some of those things, possibly. But yeah, just while we're trading Warner Brothers stories, the one I liked most is the one about, so this is June 1967, it's when Beatty and Penn screen an early cut of the film for Jack Warner.
I know where you're going. Yeah. It's a good story.
Supposedly, what they screened him was about 15 minutes longer than what was eventually released. But this is at Jack Warner's home, I think. And Warner says, "I'll tell you something right now." This is to Penn. "If I have to go pee, the picture stinks." And so, of course, they were dismayed when it was like 5 or 6 minutes into the film, apparently, when he gets up and leaves the room to relieve himself. And apparently he goes on to do that on two other occasions before the screening ends. So then the lights go up and Warner says, "That's the longest 2 hours, 10 minutes I've ever spent. It's a free piss picture." And of course, Beatty's trying to defend the film. He's like, "You know what, Jack? This is really kind of an homage to the Warner Brothers gangster films of the 30s, you know?" And of course, the famous reply is Warner saying, "What the fuck's a homage?" But it's interesting because I think maybe that's part of why Bonnie and Clyde ruffled some feathers, though. Because I talked about the outlaw kind of tradition it comes in. And the outlaw tradition was the response to certain factors. And you mentioned the Hays Code, and it kind of fits in with that too. Because you had this real-world crime wave in the Midwest, people like Dillinger, Bonnie and Clyde. You had the Hays Office coming under pressure about gangster films. And then you just have Hollywood's tendency to kind of transform genres to freshen them up as well, is kind of at play here. So the outlaw was always somebody who's defined by like their individualism and their lifestyle. They're always on the go. They're always on the move. At that time, in the 30s, it was, you can read that about as being representative of the Depression era America. Now, the thing with the Hays Code is the outlaw was often positioned as like the antagonist. You'd have like a policeman protagonist and you'd have an outlaw as the antagonist. That was part of an attempt to kind of get around the code. You know, law and order can be asserted that way. So it represented this kind of shift in the gangster image. So Bonnie and Clyde is kind of an exception then, isn't it? Because the Hays Code has become progressively weaker, and that kind of like law and order narrative kind of fades away after a certain point. But yeah, there's no getting around the fact that Bonnie and Clyde is a film that assumes that you're interested in these figures. It's not necessarily a film. I mean, they do die at the end, of course. But I think it's kind of absent some of the kind of conventional moralizing of films like the G-Men films from earlier eras. You know what I mean? I think people didn't quite know how to respond to that in a lot of cases.
Yeah, I think that because there's not really the focus on those characters. You know, the lawmen are there, but they're functional, essentially. It's about the mindset of Bonnie and Clyde and the restlessness of them both, you know, in that they, you know, there's a level of chance and fate to the fact that they happen even to meet. You know, Bonnie just looks out the window, sees Clyde, they do a bit of flirting and they're off. And straight away they're off. You know, they're off in the car. She's all over him, mauling him. And then within 5 minutes, they're shooting up holding up a store. You know, and that's it. It's a spiral then. And the whole film has a freewheeling, spiraling intensity to it in that they're just off. And they don't care. They don't care about the system they're in at all. You know, they don't have any, you know, they don't, Bonnie doesn't in many ways worry about the fact she's a waitress and she has a job to go to a lot. The only thing she ends up being anxious about is her mom. She wants to see her mom again. And then when her mom basically rejects her and says, "Look, if you stay in one place, you're going to die because you don't, this isn't what, you know." So it's fascinating in the sense that you just feel it's a snowball that is only going to end in one way. There's a real sense of nihilism to the film. I mean, obviously it's a true story, isn't it? You know, everyone knows the legend of Bonnie and Clyde. Most people know that they end up dying. And, you know, the film takes liberties, obviously, with the story, but it does also have the accurate ending. They did end up shot up and shot and killed in 1931 in a hail of bullets. So most people will go into the film knowing that's where it's going to go. But I think along the way, you know, the fact they then, it snowballs, they pick up Clyde's brother, played by Gene Hackman, and his wife, Estelle Parsons, who won an Oscar for the hysterical turn as Blanche. And then, you know, even coming into contact with people like Gene Wilder and Evans as the middle class couple who they steal a car, you know, and like you say, Michael C. Pollard, all these characters who just end up snowballing on the ride with them. There is, I think Arthur Penn's talked about how one of the things that he felt growing up in the Great Depression as a kid was that there was a restlessness amongst people who felt the economic devastation of their world. You know, they couldn't escape with the same sort of carefreeness that the 60s brought, with the fact it was economically prosperous and it was a different kind of world and a different kind of America. But they there was a shared feeling that they were on the cusp of change. And obviously that does happen with the Second World War and everything that then comes after that. So I think there's a parallel in a way with that restlessness that you really feel epitomised in Bonnie and Clyde, that is really strong, and it's what the conservative old sentimentality couldn't get their head around. People like Jack Warner can't understand a film which is all about the visceral thrill of the violence and the, you know, the blood and the lack of care for systems. You know, they happily, you know, pulling up to people and going, "We rob banks," you know, and it's morally reprehensible to a lot of people what they're doing, but the audience is sitting there loving the fantasy of it and the escape of it. And I think that's why it was so powerful, in that they couldn't, this is what the young people wanted to see in cinema and the older guard couldn't understand.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because, like, it develops as the film rolls on, doesn't it? Like, those early robberies are quite comic, aren't they? Like, there's the one where they go in and the guy's like, "Well, there's no money here," like, you know, that.
Yeah.
That
kind of yeah.
And then it's gradually as it ensues, people start dying, and it kind of, you know, I think there are reports of audience members who settle in to watch Bonnie and Clyde. From the first few scenes, they think it's a comedy, and then they're kind of knocked off guard by what comes later, you know.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, there's that tension there. The tension between the old and the new, it runs all the way through this film, from the way it was made to the way it was received by audiences and critics and people like Jack Warner, of course. So, like, at the first public screening of the film, and this apparently was attended by, you know, all sorts of great figures, people like Billy Wilder, George Stevens, who you'd associate with older times. So yeah. the film ends as reportedly, this is like the reception to Bonnie and Clyde in microcosm, I think, because there's reportedly this long silence at the end of the film, and then many of the audience erupted into cheers. So just really interesting. You can almost feel a kind of tension or ambivalence there, you know. And then, of course, when it was, well, I suppose that's all to do with the outlaw history, isn't it? Because, I mean, you can talk about gangster outlaws, but you can trace that archetype back to people like Jesse James or Robin Hood, you know. These people who, like, the state regard as criminals, but they have this popular appeal. So, like, I think that's what had happened with figures like the real Bonnie and Clyde. They got all this press attention. You know, they were fictionalized in various ways, like true crime stories, in songs as well, in films. And of course, that poem that Bonnie sends in, which is like dramatized in the film, of course. So there's this kind of romanticness attached to it too, you know. But yeah, I think what's also really interesting is, like, when the film was released, and like it had a very distinctive reception, and it kind of shifted around and stuff. So the quote I've got here is from Bosley Crowther's review in the New York Times, where he slated it. You know, he called it a cheap piece of bald-faced slapstick that treats the hideous depredations of that sleazy, moronic pair as though they were as full of the fun and frolic as the Jazz Age cut-ups in Thoroughly Modern Millie, which was a Julie Andrews musical at the time. So yeah, there are plenty of pieces out there like that. I mean, it was different, though, in other cases. I'm sure you're going to touch on that, maybe.
It does sort of trigger a critics' war, I think, in many ways, and that you've got critics on the one side, people like Joe Morgenstern, who were, you know, sticking up for the film, and then you've got Bosley Crowther, who was a really interesting character in that he maybe is slightly forgotten, you know, in the slipstream of people like Roger Ebert and Pauline Kael, you know, the film critics who've gone on to be legends themselves. But he was writing reviews since the 30s, and he was, at the time, he was seen as quite a, you know, he almost like, you know, if in the UK, you know, you've got figures like, you know, Michael Billington, who's the theatre guy for years, you know, he's the one who can make or break a show opening in the West End. Bosley Crowther, for a time, was the guy whose review they feared. You know, if he gave his thumbs up, then great. If he gave his thumbs down, then you're in trouble. And he hated Bonnie and Clyde, but he changed. You know, he changed his mind. Within 10 years, he'd started to see the benefit of it. But what it did, ultimately, the sort of war it triggered within that sort of New York theatre critic, cinema critic circle and the Hollywood critic circle, is that he ended up out on his ear, basically. He ended up being sort of put into pasture because it was seen, once Bonnie and Clyde It had sort of a limited theatrical release at first, but then when it actually fully came out, it was a massive success. And I think that was a sign of the times that these critics were wrong. You know, for most of the general public, they called it wrong. They got it wrong. They were looking at it from an angle of, you know, moral outrage, when in reality, they couldn't understand the viewpoint of this new generation coming up, who I don't think wanted to sort of venerate Bonnie and Clyde as such as people and the crimes they did, but they loved the style of those characters. They loved the freedom of those characters. Even if it ends tragically, they loved the idea that, you know, I mean, crucially, the costumes for Bonnie, made by Theodora Van Runkle in the film, go on to set off a fashion craze. You know, the beret and the skirt, you know, that Faye Dunaway wears in the late 60s, it becomes a thing. And, you know, you have to stop and think, well, actually, that's based on a murderer, essentially, and a bank robber at war. And so there is what to some people like Bosley Crowther, there was a moral, you know, wrongness almost in looking at these characters and seeing something to admire. But I think what they got wrong was the idea that the youth wanted, you know, to glamorize and enjoy the idea of these people murdering people, when that wasn't the point. It wasn't about that. It was about what these people represented in an era where also you've got Vietnam happening at the same time. And I mentioned this earlier, but that's a key factor in terms of the violence, in that Arthur Penn didn't want to sugarcoat. He didn't want to have the cuts away before you see a gunshot or not see a blood or that kind of thing. He wanted to show it, because he said, you know, if we're seeing Vietnam on the news and we're hearing about our young men going off and being slaughtered, then we're not going to shy away from showing blood. We're not going to shy away from showing violence. We're not going to shy away from this stuff anymore, because this is what is happening in the real world. And it was another reason why they didn't want to shoot it in black and white either. And they wanted the colorization of it. So I think the critics, you know, and even Pauline Kael, though, she didn't like it at first, and she sort of compared it to, you know, films like The Manchurian Candidate for being quite groundbreaking. But that was a different thing, you know, and I think she was, again, had a renaissance in terms of how she saw the film. So I think in the end it proved that the whole system was changing faster than even the critics, to many extent, could really keep up with.
And I think the significance of that is that it was a time when film critics had more power then than they do now, you know, because films, they didn't really have the same release patterns they do now. Films opened slowly. They were typically released in New York and Los Angeles first, then they would go elsewhere. So, good reviews were crucial to helping films pick up momentum, as well as, you know, positive word of mouth, having a lot of print advertising, things like that. But it's very different now, isn't it? Like, there are lots of films now we regard as critic-proof, and I'm not sure there's any single critic who has the sort of clout that some of these figures we're talking about did, you know. I think Kael's review is very interesting because, yeah, I'll just read the first few sentences from it. It's a really long piece. It's really good, but it's about 10,000 words long, I think. But I'd encourage people to check it out. How do you make a good movie in this country without being jumped on? Bonnie and Clyde is the most excitingly American movie since The Manchurian Candidate. The audience is alive to it. When an American movie is contemporary in feeling like this one, it makes a different kind of contact with an American audience from the kind that is made by European films, however contemporary. So I think when we talk about Penn eventually doing the film, people like Truffaut had been courted or whatever, I think it probably needed an American to have the kind of quintessential American-ness that it does have. But I think Kael hits on lots of interesting stuff in that review. And I thought, we've talked about Beatty and Dunaway and this idea that just because they're so attractive, it kind of glamorizes these figures. And I really like the way she kind of tackles that argument. So she says, if movie stars can't play criminals without our all wanting to be criminals, then maybe the only safe roles for them to play are movie stars. After all, if they played factory workers, the economy might be dislocated by everybody's trying to become a factory worker. So I like the way she thinks a lot of the arguments about the film, like people clutching at straws, basically. And she sort of says, like, why, you know, you only ever hear these responses to notable films, to good films. She sort of says it seems to suggest that people were just so used to kind of mind-numbing, repetitive commercial fare. You know, I think that's very interesting. And I think it's probably true, to be fair. I mean, if you look at that year's Academy Awards, it's kind of indicative of that old-new dichotomy, you know. it's really interesting how it got there, because like, it's not just the critics, some of them, who were kind of out of step with this. I think even the first round of moviegoers were, because the film did okay in places like New York when it first came out. Not even better than okay, just okay. I only played for around a fortnight in the South. Like you say, in England, it started this fashion trend. It did much better in England, I think. And then it was the fact that the Time magazine thing, where it puts the film on the cover, it's talking about the new cinema and stuff. I think that's what enabled Beatty to successfully argue for a re-release. And then it's just kind of serendipitous. The day Bonnie and Clyde was re-released was the same day the Oscar nominations were announced, and it gets 10 nominations. And that's when the commercial success comes into play. Like, I've seen reports like cinemas who had made just a couple of $1,000s off the film the first time, and that goes up like tenfold on the re-release, you know. So yeah, I think ultimately it was one of the top 20 highest grossing films up to that point, you know. And then it gets to the Oscars, and it's up against a really interesting batch of films, you know, because it's up against like a traditional musical in Dr. Dolittle. It's alongside The Graduate. I think that's another kind of modern upstart, you know, Dustin Hoffman starring film, of course. And then it's up against more safer, liberal fare, I think. Stuff like In the Heat of the Night, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. So of that group, I think it's Bonnie and Clyde and The Graduate are these two kind of markers for what's coming up next. But I don't know, I'd be kind of curious to hear. I know you're covering In the Heat of the Night, aren't you, soon on the podcast? So I'd be interested to see how you feel that kind of slots in as well. But yeah.
Yeah, In the Heat of the Night is slightly different in that it's much more angled on trying to make a point about race as it is about necessarily being a innovative sort of trend-setting film. You know, it is different in that sense. The Graduate, like you say, is more along the lines of a film that is really sort of, shaking things up, pushing at the conventions of what was possible. They are different kinds of films, but they're touching on somewhat, on similar ground in some ways, in some thematic ideas. And I think there is a real, those Oscars are fascinating. There is in Scenes from a Revolution particularly, there's a lot of detail on that Oscar ceremony and a lot of what was going on at the time, because you had films like Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, which was, at the time, the people making it thought they were making something really progressive and liberal, and then everyone turned around and went, well, actually, you're not. Because, you know, you've got Sidney Poitier playing who just happens to be a black man in a white role, essentially. So there's lots of things with that film, and you know, the car crash production of Dr. Dolittle, which led to that film, you know, probably not really worthy of being Oscar nominated, and all these kind of things. There's lots of stuff going on around the time at how the industry is sort of, you know, reacting to these realities. But I think there is something about the image of the performances in Bonnie and Clyde. But just returning to that, I mean, one of the things that's important to mention is that at the time, They wanted to really make something about Clyde being potentially homosexual, which isn't anywhere in the film. And it was supposed to be a big thing, and Warren Beatty didn't want to do it. And I think he was worried about his image. He was worried about his image as a movie star. You know, and you mentioned, you know, Pauline Kael talking about movie stars. And it was essentially replaced by The Impotence, pretty much. You know, it was put in there. But he was okay to play that, but he didn't want to play a guy who was, you know, there was also supposed to be a threesome in the film as well, or very strong hints of a threesome. And these were things that were sanded off, ultimately. So while it is edgy and visceral, it is trying to appease, in some senses, a system that still exists. But it's a beginning. It is a beginning. And I think that the fact that it didn't win all the Oscars, I think Estelle Parsons won for Blanche. I think Bernard Guffey won for cinematography, which is interesting because he was he'd been working since like the 20s or the 30s. He was an old guy. And he at first didn't get it. He didn't get the film they were making. And he left the production, and then they got another guy on who was even older, who was a complete mess. And then they asked Bernard Guffey to come back. And then he started to get the rhythm of what the film was about. And obviously he won an Oscar. But I don't think really he necessarily understood a lot what was going on. So Bonnie and Clyde does sit in this weird middle point of, you know, made essentially by a contribution of people from the old system and this burgeoning new system, and having to straddle both worlds while at the same time setting the template for what's to come, and leaving what I think would be a really fascinating legacy in terms of what it starts with New Hollywood. I mean, what kind of, I suppose it's a good place to sort of come to an end with this, because what kind of legacy do you think that Bonnie and Clyde had not just for the new Hollywood movement, but in general on cinema over the next, particularly, I suppose, the next 10, 15 years when this system's changing?
I mean, you can certainly see particular films that you can say are very much influenced by Bonnie and Clyde. I think a film like Badlands, the Terrence Malick film. I think stuff like True Romance a bit later, Natural Born Killers, some of those early Tarantino scripts, you know, these kind of star-crossed lovers on the run type narratives. I think it's very important specifically in that regard. I think it's just the fact, like I said earlier, it marks this kind of point of departure. You know, it paved the way for a lot of other things, you know. This artificially constructed sense, but it's a weird thing that also feels very real. You know, the fact that you can grab somebody's attention by doing something ostentatious, like rapid editing, like, you know, all this explicit bloodshed. And you can do that in a way that kind of rattles people. I think that's significant. I think the fact that it's a film that had this kind of dual appeal. You know, it appealed not just to many critics, but to an audience, you know. So it's kind of hard to imagine now. It's hard to imagine a film like Bonnie and Clyde being released now that would go on to be such a big box office hit. Obviously, it kind of faltered on the way to getting there, but it got there. And I think it's hard to imagine things like The Godfather being big blockbusters these days in the way that some of the films are, you know. So I think it marks the point at which those things start to be possible in this new American cinema, you know. So I think it's very influential. And I think it's interesting, though, because I think some of these things, like I think we talked about Beatty and Dunaway, like I think from the contemporary reviews I've read, there's a kind of sense of surprise that these people can do this, you know, because like you say, Dunaway is just coming on the scene. Beatty, you know, had been in films, but they weren't necessarily things people raved over. You know, so like, that's what Pauline Kael says in her reviews. Like, she said, the joke in The Glamour Charge is that Faye Dunaway has the magazine illustration look of countless uninterestingly pretty girls, and Warren Beatty has the kind of high school good looks that are generally lost fast. And that's kind of weird to me, because I think before I'd seen Bonnie and Clyde, I'd seen Dunaway in Chinatown and Network and stuff like that, and I'd never thought of her as uninterestingly pretty, I must confess. And I think even now, I mean, Warren Beatty looks pretty good for an 80-year-old. I think he's wrong on that. Yeah. So yeah, it's a significant film for these performers. It's a significant film for what it points towards. I think it's probably the broader point of what I was trying to get at there.
It's funny because I think there are films subsequent to this that people maybe remember more, you know. But I think it has retained a legacy. It has retained, even if people don't necessarily know all of the beats to it, you know, and all the bits and bobs. I think it has retained a power maybe over people who make films more so than the audience itself to some extent. I think or certainly in the following sort of next couple of decades, I think it's not a perfect film by any means of the imagination, but it's important. I think it's an important piece of cinema. And I think it's important to say at this point as well that this podcast, while it's going to be talking about how the new Hollywood was fantastic and created some fantastic movies, you know, and really did shake up the system, I think it's really important to point out that the system before this produced some amazing movies. And if it wasn't for that system and the way it worked, which is your bread and butter, as we've said on the Movie Palace, you wouldn't have been able to have a new system emerge at a time of real sort of cultural and social change. So I don't want anyone to think this podcast is going to be trying to make the point that new Hollywood was brilliant and that all this old rubbish was being swept away, because that's not the case. And, you know, I would encourage anyone to listen to the Movie Palace if they haven't, because you cover so many movies on there that are examples of great cinema which were just made at a different time in a different age.
Yeah, most definitely. I think that, I mean, to be fair, we sort of pick the one, or I pick the ones that I think are worth discussing still. I'm sure that, you know, Hollywood churned out so much stuff that I'm not sure all the kind of like singing cowboy films are historically significant, you know, and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But no, it's definitely true. And that's kind of like where you can join some of these dots together with some of the things we've been talking about with Bonnie and Clyde. Because, yeah, people like Truffaut and Goddard, they loved people like Hitchcock and Hawks and John Ford, you know, generally speaking. So, yeah, they had mixed feelings about commercial cinema, but they were very, you know, attuned to these people who could put their stamp on commercial products, you know. And that's kind of what's interesting with the new Hollywood era to me, is that, yeah, films you wouldn't necessarily think of as big crowd pleasers, you know, they actually found considerable audiences at this point in time. Mm. In a way that I don't know if it occurs in the same way today with cinema anyway. It seems like long-form streaming streaming series is the way that happens now in many cases. But no, it was just a really interesting kind of liminal time, and like it couldn't go on forever. And I'm sure we'll talk about this in the future, if we're back on future episodes. But it was a very kind of, very notable, distinctive period, you know. And like, I guess all good things come to an end. But yeah, it's kind of fun to be here at, you know, the film which arguably marks the outset of that, though.
Definitely. And it's been brilliant to talk to you about it and go through this. You know, this is one we've talked about doing for a long time, really, isn't it? You know, we've had the new wave on the planning board for a good couple of years now, and it's just something that only now, really, I've had the time to really knuckle down and do. So it's great to finally tackle this film. And for now, it's you're back to the past for you, Carl. Back to the years before this. So what's coming up on the Movie Palace, and where can people find it, and tell us a little bit about you and what you're up to.
Okay, so where people can find it, first of all, is wherever good podcasts and not so good podcasts are found. All the usual places, I think, iTunes, you know, Apple, etc. At Movie Palace Pod on Twitter, also on Facebook and Instagram. Just a quick search for Movie Palace should throw us up on there. In terms of what else we'll be covering, well, if people have been interested in the gangster stuff we kind of touched on here, I've kind of tried to tie it in with what we're doing here. So we're also, at about this time, you know, might have already come out or might be coming soon, not entirely sure yet, but hopefully covering The Public Enemy, which is a James Cagney kind of racketeer classic gangster film. When we talked about things like Scarface, it's very much one of the best films of that kind of cycle. Hopefully doing a crossover, another Cagney film, White Heat, with the 250 podcast, because that's a film that's on the IMDb's top 250 list of all time. And then beyond that, I've got something planned, and I'm going to speak to you about this, Tony. I haven't mentioned it yet, but I will. But hopefully you'll be a part of this if you agree.
Exciting, yeah.
Got kind of a little mini series planned on the Alfred Hitchcock film Psycho, which celebrates its 60th anniversary this year. Again, another interesting film earlier, but you know, in terms of like contemporary feeling, that's a film that shook people up too. So that's kind of what's coming up, yeah. And then just over 50 back episodes, if people want to go and find out, you know, all sorts of stuff. Episodes on things like Casablanca, Double Indemnity, Some Like It Hot, which you and I did not too long ago.
Yep.
So I'd encourage people just to scan their eyes down the list if they want to check it out. And there's bound to be something that kind of appeals to you. I'm sure there will be.
Yeah.
The Movie Palace is my podcast, at Movie Palace Pod, just again on Twitter.
Yeah, there's so many great... I mean, what I'm enjoying is digging out these old films from where I can find them on streaming or, you know, wherever, and watching them for this podcast. You know, that's something I'm really enjoying doing, because it's certainly giving me a broader idea of cinema. And you've covered all kinds of different genres and all kinds of different things on that show. So it's great. So you will absolutely find something on there that you'll enjoy, definitely. So yeah, you can find me personally at AJ Black Writer on Twitter. And if you want to find the podcast network that both our shows are part of, you can find them at We Made This Pod on Twitter and at wemadethispod.com. And do go and check out all the other shows. We'll give you a little taster at the end of this episode on what's coming up on the network. But we're going to be back very soon, talking about another film in the new Hollywood era. So we're going to have different kinds of stars on this show. We're going to do sometimes we're going to go through a year, sometimes we're going to go through a director, sometimes we're going to mix it up and go through different years. Thanks again, Carl. It's been great to have you on the show. You will be back at some point, definitely.
Cheers, Tony. I just wanted to say, I think, if we're saying this is kind of a spin-off from my podcast, I think this will be a kind of like a Frasier Cheers situation, where there's a strong case that the spin-off is just as good as the forerunner. So yeah, thank you.
Well, that's the best compliment you could have given me, I think. So cheers. I've got to live up to that now. But yeah, and thanks again for everyone who is listening to this first episode, and I hope you stay with us until next time. And until next time we explore New Hollywood, keep enjoying the pictures. Previously on the We Made This Network. Pull or pass?
If it wasn't for this show, I wouldn't be buying anywhere near as many single issues as I do. I just was always happier with trades until we did this show, really.
Yeah, I think that it's a large part of where I've come from as well. I own far more trades than singles. Working in a comic book shop and doing the show has encouraged me to go for more singles. But like I say, the last couple of months, I don't have singles and it doesn't bother me.
We buy records.
Do you ever read music mags?
No.
Did you ever used to?
I used to buy them all.
And so then why, just suddenly... why did you stop buying them?
You may have heard of it, Tim. It's called The Internet.
No. And what does that do? Is that a magazine?
Yeah, it's like a magazine, but you can also listen, for example, when...
So it's got a CD cover mount.
Yes, exactly that.
Where can I get it?
Usually you have to go to Dixon's and you get a disc.
Yes.
They'll give it you to for free.
With like
you
put 500 the disc in... hours.
Yeah, exactly
free
that. Yeah.
Access.
Yeah.
Oh, that sounds really good. Okay.
Yeah,
so
you should try
Dixon's
it.
Dixon's or Rumbelows. Right, okay, I'm going to try
Rumbelows definitely do them, yes.
It's a bit of fun, isn't it?
Without a mouse.
So how's your lockdown going at the minute?
It's going all right, you know. It's going all right, Tim. I'm doing sort of slightly weird and mad things like a lot of people are, I guess. I power washed the patio for the first time in my life.
Yeah, we've done that. We've done that once, yeah.
I've taken up yoga, which... Just to colour the listeners with some context, I am 6'4" and quite awkward and out of proportion, so yoga's not really my first calling, but giving it a go.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.